S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that has an extra special guest this week. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me as always is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Hi, Captain. How are you?
I'm very well. And we have a special guest, the aforementioned Matthew Joss. G'day, Matt.
G'day. Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. All right, this is going to be a big podcast. We're going to try and get in and out in half an hour. We'll see how we go, boys. We don't have really great form on that, but we'll do our level best. We've got a lot to cover today on the podcast. Can Telstra escape from its own sinking gravity? It's been a tough couple of weeks for the telco, and maybe there's either better or worse times ahead. We'll find out what Doc has to say about that. We'll also talk about the healthcare giant Ramsay Health Care. There's not enough babies being born in its hospitals, apparently, and earnings will be down pretty significantly this year and also into next year. Matt will give us some tips on how to invest in the rest of the world. We'll talk about Disney and Fox in the US and how the entertainment landscape is being reshaped. And because Matt's here as a special guest, we're going to get him to saddle up on the guest saddle on the high horse and go for a quick lap around the Motley Fool Money track and see what he's got to offer us by way of a rant. All right, let's get into it. Telstra, Doc, it's been a pretty ugly, well, kind of almost a couple of years now, right? It's kind of struggled and fallen and struggled and fallen, but it's pretty much been one-way traffic. What's the latest news on Telstra? What's caused this last round of investor kind of, what do we call it, deserting the sinking ship? Or is it a case of maybe a bit of bad news before the good times return?
Well, Scott, it looks like Andy Penn basically threw the kitchen sink, trying to solve Telstra's problems. So the news is this: what they did is they're going to now have a separate infrastructure business. Mm-hmm. Which they're calling the Infrastructure Co. This is going to house.
That's novelty.
Yeah, such a great name. You know, just sounds like NBN Co.
Doesn't it?
This is going to house their copper, their hybrid fiber coaxial cables, right. the fiber network, data centers, and things like that. So,
okay.
I call this the old business.
Right.
And then they're going to have essentially all the infrastructure that is needed for running their mobile network.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be part of the separate business. It's going to be separate from that. They're going to have a global services business for doing back office stuff. So I guess the hope with this is that they're going to be able to focus on what's important, which is mobile. And in the process, they're also cutting lots of jobs. That's not good for morale. 9,500 to be...
Man. It's about a third of the workforce. Do I remember that correctly?
Yep.
So is this a case in your mind of rearranging deck chairs on a sinking ship, or is there some promise, some positive outcome here in what they're doing in terms of both the restructuring, and also they've talked a little bit about things like dropping prices on mobile plans, reducing the number of mobile plans from 1,800 to 20, which is some significant cut. Right? Mm-hmm. I guess you can afford to have less staff if you've got somewhere around 1% of the number of plans left over. What's kind of going on there? Is there method to the madness, mate, or is this just a rearranging of deck chairs, as I said?
Yeah, so the question is, is it too little, too late? We'll only know in the fullness of time. I think they're doing the right thing, focusing on mobile, reducing the number of plans down from 1,800 or whatever it was to 20 makes sense. I think the real neat thing here is that if they can focus on mobile and get ahead of the competition, that's very, very useful. They might be able to do things around content deals and make the data plans free for the content, for example. That could be a way to win.
Right, which kind of they're doing with NRL and AFL now, right? I've got an NRL app on my phone. As long as I'm a Telstra subscriber, I get just streaming free. Okay.
Yeah. So maybe there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel, but currently the tunnel looks pretty dark.
Long and dark, right?
Long and dark. You know, the operating earnings are going from 10 billion this year, which is down by another 10% next year. So, the big question is the dividend going to be cut?
Yeah.
We don't know. Maybe it's likely to be cut, but I don't know. So I think there's some process to the madness here, and we just got to see. There's a big wild card in what's going to happen in terms of TPG, what they're going
to
do.
Right, because they're coming in October, I think, to the ACT, and then kind of expanding from there.
Yep. And then there's Vodafone and there's Optus. And really, it's a crowded field. So the question is there any growth there over the long term?
Yeah.
Can they maintain their leadership position in mobile? And can they do some value-added services? Maybe they can take a lead from what's happening in the US with people like AT&T and Verizon, and then maybe do some advertising and stuff as value-added services to Yeah.
Now, let's talk about 5G for a second, because 5G is held out by the company and a lot of Telstra bulls, those that are left, as kind of the great hope, right? This is what's supposed to save Telstra from irrelevance or from some sort of declining terminal, you know, morass. 5G is going to be much, much faster than 4G, has the promise of higher data plans, and some people are saying it may well even rival the NBN. Where do you stand on the on 5G and what you expect kind of the telco, or the mobile telco in particular, future might look like?
So I'm very hopeful about 5G. I think 5G can deliver very high-speed downloads.
Mm-hmm.
So it can rival NBN. So, I mean, NBN could be toast, which would not be a good thing.
So you say could be. I'm going to put you on the spot. What are the odds that NBN is toast, or at least materially, you know, less sizable than it is today? If we go outside of 2027, let's make an easy 9-10 years. What's your guess as to how the mobile / NBN kind of market looks like?
So in 10 years, and I think that's looking out that far is hard.
Oh, totally.
Mobile technology, but if you're looking out 10 years, I mean, I would think, let's say 60% of people might just be on mobile only plans. That would be my guess.
Okay.
Because I would think by that time, mobile technology would have ramped up their data speeds so much.
And in that environment, the NBN sounds like the number of subscribers would roughly halve to kind of make that work if it's NBN, if mobile only for that majority of people.
Yeah, potentially.
That feels to me like a tough story for the NBN. A lot of infrastructure, a lot of cost, not much revenue. We talk about sort of retailers and other companies where you have a small drop in revenue and your whole business plan effectively goes to mush because you've got such high fixed costs. If I'm running the NBN or any infrastructure utility and all of a sudden you drop my business by half, how do you make money in that environment?
It's going to be hard, right? And I think the issue here is that NBN is also hamstrung by the fact that, in many places it's just fiber to the curb, and then you're essentially running on copper, to the houses or whole units and so on. So that puts a limit on what you can do. And if you can't compete on speed, then you maybe try to compete on price. and then again, you run into this, the high fixed cost issue, trying to recover this fixed cost over a smaller population pool.
All right, I'm putting you on the spot one more time. Would you rather be today Telstra or NBN Co?
How would I rather be none?
No. That's not the rules of this guy. I get to make the rules here. What do you reckon? NBN Co or Telstra? If you had to choose one, or you had to sell the... Maybe if you had to short one of them, only one of them, which one would you short? Which one would you go long?
Oh, if I had to short one and I had to go long one, I would short NBN and go long Telstra.
Very good.
That would be my pick.
That suits me, because I will say I'm a shareholder in Telstra. It is an active wreck at Motley Fool Share Advisor. So far, I've been wrong on the timing. I still expect to be right on the end game, which is to your point, Doc, mobile growth. I think I liked it. I like Telstra for the mobile business, and I think I'll still be right on that. What I completely cocked up was the timing of the change and the size of the change on the way through. So I expected that the NBN or the fixed loss would be slower and better. Basically, you're better paid by the government for that transition. It hasn't been the case, and there's a massive gap in earnings that's opened up. I reckon Telstra's mobile business is in a pretty good spot. It's the only telco that's growing its number of mobile subscribers. TPG will be a meaningful competitor, and so I need to be careful of that. I like TPG as well, by the way. But I fully expect that Telstra's combination of size, scale, content, as you've already mentioned, I think it's well-placed to win mobile, and that doesn't necessarily mean a lot of profit. We've seen plenty of industries where you can be big and not make any money. Take the airlines, for example. But I think the mobile business is in a good spot. I think the fixed line business is in massive trouble, and I actually agree with on NBN. I think it's very probable at 5G, and certainly if we get to a 6G type environment, the chances that we're using large amounts of fixed broadband data feels like a bit of a dead end story to me.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of businesses in trouble, Ramsay Healthcare. So for people who don't know the name, Ramsay owns a whole lot of private hospitals in Australia, some other clinics. There's a fledgling pharmacy business. It also owns hospitals in France, in the UK, and a couple around Asia. This week it said, well, earnings are going to be down, and it's because people aren't having enough babies. What's going on?
Well, just people aren't having enough babies. We need to encourage more baby births.
Peter Costello famously said everyone should have three kids, one for mum, one for dad, and one for the country. It sounds like Ramsay might be on the same political playbook.
Or maybe they want six.
I'm sure they'd take it.
Well, okay. I'm not sure. In their earnings downgrade that they released, they didn't. At least I didn't see this, but I skimmed through it, so I might have missed it. But what they basically said is essentially procedures are down.
Yeah.
both in Australia and in the UK.
Correct. Yeah.
And that basically means inpatient as well as, you know, those day procedures and things like that.
Inpatient being medical speak, people who stay at least one night, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Some of this could be rationalization by the by the UK's national health system in terms of, you know, they deciding longer wait periods and so on and so forth, which has an impact on how many procedures are going to be done now. But to me, it looks like this is a company that should do well over the long term. It's never going to be a big grower because, well, you know, there are only so many procedures that happen.
Right.
And you should expect maybe, you know, mid to high single digit procedures growth over time.
Yeah. Because there's a decent growth in that, right? We're all getting older, we're living longer, we're all having more procedures. So it's decent. And the growth so far has been largely a matter of acquisition. They bought a whole lot of French, UK, Asian hospitals. So to some degree, it's kind of, so you're saying there's a mid-single digit maybe growth in procedures in developed markets?
Yeah.
It comes down to how many either acquisitions or greenfield developments it can do to try and take market share in those other countries.
Right. And the thing here is that, you know, it's a company that has got well-established procedures. It can take its model and apply it to, say, other emerging economies, right? And there's a big opportunity there. How material that's going to be to earnings, we don't know. Whether they're going to be paying a lot to, you know, acquire into these markets, we don't know. But, I mean, it's been, you know, disciplined so far. And if it continues on that path, I mean, you know, the downgrade wasn't that big a deal to me. It looked like, you know, they said 7% growth in earnings this year versus what they'd guided, I don't know, like 8 to 10%. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a slowdown. But
now, a little bit of a slowdown, but the shares were absolutely smashed. What's going on?
Well, the shares were very expensive on a price to earnings ratio. Right, so the market is expecting something.
Can we throw in the market cliche, price for perfection? Is that a reasonable starting point for Ramsey?
That's a reasonable, actually, I'd say that's a very good explanation. It was price for perfection.
Yeah.
They didn't deliver perfect results, and therefore the market took it to the, you know.
Can we finally smash the whole what's a polite way to say it? Can we smash the whole standby of healthcare being a defensive industry, nothing ever goes wrong, that somehow Ramsey is superhuman and deserves those? I mean, if forever it's been a case of, well, it's Ramsey and it's high quality and it's healthcare, so of course we can pay 30 times earnings. I mean, to some degree, that always felt like a bit of a mistake, and maybe it's easy for me to say in hindsight, but if you think about kind of the way we treat some of these companies, as if nothing can possibly go wrong, they're worth paying anything, any price for, because somehow being defensive in healthcare must mean that you can suspend the old rule.
Yeah, so I would partially agree with you. If you take a really long-term view, and I mean, you paid 30 times earnings and you hold this for like 10 years, I think you'd make decent money. The odds are that you'd beat the market, whether you did it at 30 times earnings. Of course, if you buy it at 20 times earnings, you're going to do better. So I mean, cheaper is always better, but you know, it is cheaper today. What if it reported 11% earnings growth and not 7% earnings growth, stock was then trading at like 35 times earnings, right? So it's always, I think there's a bit of a hindsight bias to that. I mean, we always need to pay the right price for this type of business. It's a mature business. But I do think it's defensive. I mean, for all the reasons that you just stated, right?
Sure.
You know, people living longer procedures, improvements in medical systems, software, medical technology, new drugs and everything.
It's got a decent tailwind behind it, right, as an industry. We're all getting older. All that kind of good stuff.
We're all getting older, and the developing market is, you know, they have more money. They're becoming, there's a rising middle class in Asia. So, I think it's a good company.
All right. Now, Matt, I was going to give you this topic off, but I am going to drag you in here because you are Mr. Valuation for us, the Motley Fool. So, for those who don't know, Matt, you run Motley Fool Pro, which is soundly smashing the market. So I'll give you a bit of praise. You won't do it yourself, but I'll do it for you.
Very kind.
So I'm going to ask you just your valuation, not about Ramsey necessarily, although feel free to talk about Ramsey, but 30 times earnings for any company, worth paying, not worth paying? How do you think about Ramsey at 30 times earnings?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the cash flows they're generating, to Neobun's point, right? Like 30 times suddenly looks very cheap if a company's growing very fast. For Ramsey, for me, it's probably a bit stretched. I think to your point, like we're not seeing the type of growth that I'd like to see. We look to some international companies that are growing much faster than that and at reasonable multiples. So, yeah, for me, it's not so much the multiple that you might see on earnings. It's digging into the the cash discounted cash flow and kind of projecting all that stuff forward. But if you back it out, you can't kind of come to similar numbers quite often. So I'd say probably a similar conclusion, probably a bit stretched around 30, and nice to get them when they're trading at a discount.
All right. Now, I'm not going to ask you to explain discounted cash flows on radio because that's not particularly great listening. Particularly when you get to discount rates and compound numbers. But give our listeners the quick 30-second, maybe a minute if you need to, rundown on kind of the concept of discounted cash flows. So no numbers, just pure concept.
Yeah.
What
I think I tried this last time. It's a very tough topic.
You did,
but
we've got new listeners since then. Let's try again. I've sprung this on you, so fair play if you do struggle, but I don't think you will. Give us a quick rundown on kind of what the idea of discounted cash flow is for, why you would use it valuation wise.
Yeah. So essentially, we're trying to get a handle on what drives a business and effectively predict what it's going to do going forward, but it's much more about understanding kind of a range of different scenarios, if that makes sense. So
right. Yep.
The way I typically go through is try and get a handle on how much is the business going to grow its revenue over the next, say, 10 years, then work through the whole way through the profit and loss statement, trying to figure out how much that means for the bottom line. And we focus on cash flow, not profit. The small difference there being that it can be quite easy for a company to manipulate profit. We've all heard about companies that make $1 billion profit 1 year, and then next year they're suddenly writing off $2 billion and all this kind of funny stuff that can go on.
Speaking of Telstra.
So it strips out some of the shenanigans that can happen. And of course, there are other shenanigans that can happen with cash flow.
They really
don't
are.
Don't need to get into that. But yeah. So that's really the key. And then the discounted part, all that we're trying to say there is that the dollar that you earn in 10 years' time isn't quite as valuable to you as a dollar that you earn right now. We all know about that from inflation, but it's also just the opportunity cost, right? Like, you'd much rather have a dollar in the hand now than in 10 years' time.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, so that's what we're doing. We're really just trying to kind of forecast the cash flows of the business and then discount those back to today. So how much are those worth to us today? That's what we're talking about.
So effectively, how much of a discount do you want for waiting for that money to come
in? Yeah, exactly. And that's where the different companies can have different discount rates we're talking about. If something's very risky, you'd probably want to discount that more. So you'd want more money in year 10.
It's a higher margin of safety, can I say?
Yeah, effectively. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That makes sense. Thank you, mate. We didn't drag you in for that, but thank you for jumping in.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, we did speak about the concept of investing internationally, I think you might have mentioned. And so what we did ask you to come in, other than to share your massive success in Motley Fool Pro, I want to say the service is up 204%.
204% last Friday, yes.
And the market's up about 37% at the same time?
Yes, correct.
So 204 is bigger than 37, yeah?
Yeah, okay.
Just clarifying that. Mate, that is spectacular results. And full credit to your predecessors, including Doc, who was worked on Motley Fool Pro with you at some point. Also to Ryan, who works with you on Motley Fool Pro now. That being said, and why we asked you to come in, other than to share that success, was you have made something of a success out of investing in international businesses, or maybe we should say investing in proceeds from overseas. Tell us a little bit about how you can invest overseas from here at home.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a big part of what Pro's done since day one. So we launched in 2014. And the kind of makeup of the portfolio today, we're 100% invested in ASX listed companies and instruments.
That's not what I asked about. I asked about overseas investing.
Exactly. That's what I'm getting to. So 100% in ASX, but 60% of their revenues, or over 60%, are generated internationally. So these are companies that are listed in Australia, but they're really international businesses. Some of them up to 99% of their revenue is generated overseas.
That's a lot, yeah?
Yeah, that's a lot. So it's quite different from the rest of the ASX, right? Like a lot of the ASX, I would say, are kind of big fish in a small pond. And that can be really good. You can have a company, particularly if it's kind of dominating its niche, that can be really good, or dominating quite a big area.
Yep.
But what we like to find is a small fish in a big pond that can then become a big fish in a big pond. So we like to find that small company that's got a really big potential addressable market. So I think Nirban talks about this quite a lot, but the big total addressable market means a big opportunity for growth. And that's something we like to see. And we typically see that the best businesses, in our case, not in all cases, but often, are companies that can grow and scale that much internationally. So that draws us towards them. So that's kind of the fundamental reason, I guess you'd say, that the very best businesses, particularly if you're thinking like a software business, they can ship to the whole world at once, right?
Right. Okay. So break it down for me a little bit. If you're thinking about how you're picking stocks at Pro, are you telling me you're looking for international businesses per se, or are you just looking for businesses and markets that provide attractive returns? So you say 60% of the revenues are from overseas, still 40% from Australia. So in some senses, do you have any businesses that are just purely domiciled in Australia, or they all have international exposure in some way or other?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. I'm just trying to think if we have, I think we have, yeah, we have maybe one or two. Okay. Yeah, not very many.
So is it fair to say it's a core part of you? Would you be likely to pick a company with only Australian exposure? What would help that decision?
Yeah, so we absolutely would. I guess there's another factor as well that benefits from international. So when you buy international exposure, you're getting huge global diversification. So that's another portfolio benefit. So we're kind of pulled in both directions, pull us towards this international exposure. So from a bottom-up fundamental point of view, we find often the best companies tend to be growing internationally. And sometimes we'll buy one that's just an Australian company and then it expands internationally. So then it becomes an international company. But there's also a big portfolio benefit. So we get exposure to all these different markets. If something goes wrong in the Australian economy, we're not just hit with that.
Okay.
There's a case. I won't go into that case. I think you've probably talked about it before around Australian housing and the Australian
not
economy.
Again.
We love housing.
God.
So there's a lot of reasons to be cautious, I'd say, and to at least kind of expose yourself to other markets, like for instance the US, which is just booming at the moment, and plenty of other markets. So that's kind of the other angle, I guess, coming from a portfolio construction point of view. If you have companies that are growing in all these different areas, it's a lot more balanced.
So let me go back half a step then. Are you looking for international exposure because in general it's good, or because of a concern you have about the Australian market right now? If we're in a different situation in 5 years' time, are you likely to have less international exposure than you do now? Is it a response to the times, or is it kind of a more basic fundamental investing approach?
It's primarily a basic fundamental investing approach. I don't think we'd ever not have some international company exposure and quite a big chunk. I do think it would vary a little bit though. So for instance, the Aussie dollar, you know, there's been times where we've had a view on that. I'd still have a view that it's more likely to fall than to rise from this point relative to the US dollar. So that does kind of shape the thinking. If we're thinking, well, you know, if the Aussie dollar falls 10%, that's a pretty big tailwind.
So you're betting on Forex now, is that what you're telling me?
I like to have the wind at my back. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. There.
He's a sailor.
Nice. Now, I'm going to ask one last question, because we talked about discounted cash flows before, and a lot of people will hear that and think, Matt, he's one of those kind of Ben Graham, for those who know him, or Warren Buffett in the early days, for those who know that. He's the kind of guy who's looking for the dirty, cheap value stuff. You know, he's not a growth investor, because growth investors don't really care about DCFs. I would posit though that's not necessarily true of you. And so just help me, for those who are listening who feel like you need to be either value or growth, and there's somehow this dichotomy where the two never actually match up. I don't think that describes your approach. You do speak with a value investor's lingo, if you like, a value investor's kind of approach. I don't think that necessarily would put you in the usual value investor camp. Just give me a sense of kind of the way you mesh those two together to the extent you do.
Yeah, I think unfortunately there's a lot of dogma and kind of like religious thinking around value investing. So people say, I'm a value investor, and so I never invest in something that's growing or that's at a multiple more
than
20 times.
You can't pay more than book value, right?
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And I think I came from a very traditional value investing school, so came through the kind of Graham and Dodd, you know, style, but then realized that there's this huge opportunity for growing businesses and that you can apply valuation to them as well. So it's kind of the last step in research typically.
Okay.
We go and meet with a company, talk to competitors, do a whole lot of deep qualitative research, and then valuation using a DCF is normally our last step to kind of see, is this a good buy today? So, it's about merging the two. And I think that's the area where there's the most opportunity for active managers like us, because a lot of that obvious stuff that was discovered, you know, in the 1930s, that's mostly gone now. It's very hard to be competing literally with computers. And so I think the edge that we can have is we can form a different view by doing a lot of qualitative research that then kind of ties in with that more quantitative value investing. So the two are very much joined. And I think growth, all investing is based on valuation, in my view, my style. But it still means that I love high growth companies. So most of our companies are growing revenue at 20%, 30% a year, or sometimes much higher.
So I'm going to posit, and you can respond to this, that to some degree where you differ from most value investors, is not that you don't use the same toolkit, but you're more prepared to take either a longer term view, or maybe just simply not be so conservative in being afraid to put in higher than usual growth rates. So the average value investor is going to look at Telstra and say, well, it's worth 250 or 280 or something like that, because it's going to go at 4 or 6%. So that you know, when I roll the numbers through a complicated spreadsheet, that's what I get. You're more likely to look at a company, maybe put in some higher than higher estimates of future growth than most value investors would be kind of comfortable with. Is that kind of where that kind of diverges a little bit from the average Graham and Dodd type value investor?
Yeah, I think that's quite fair. I think a lot of investors will look at a growth company and kind of just be too cautious to do anything more than the next year will be good, and then they just kind of stop from there. Whereas really the value, and that's where that long-term time horizon comes in, the real value is just compounding at those high rates. If you can do 30% for 10 years, that's an insanely valuable company. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of it. We think about the S-curve of growth a lot. So a company that's just starting to take off, if you think about anything that grows biologically, I guess, is an S-curve normally, is a slow start and then a very rapid ramp up.
Okay.
So we try to buy companies that are just tipping into that rapid ramp up, and that can mean growth rates actually increase in the future, which is not something a traditional analyst would just kind of drag that spreadsheet forward, you know, drag that cell across project the recent past. And so it's more about kind of incorporating a different view of the future, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you to hang around because I do have one last task for you at the end of the podcast.
Sounds good.
If you do want to hear more about Motley Fool Pro, we are going to open it in the next couple of days. So you can go to www.fool.com.au/MMM, sign up for Motley Fool Take Stock, which is our free investing newsletter, and we will have some promotional material for you and tell you how you can join Motley Fool Pro, which is just absolutely stonkingly smashing the market right now and a testament to the guys and the work they're doing. So if you are interested, have a look. No obligation, of course, and that newsletter is free regardless, but we think we might like what you find. Doc, before we do move on, though, I want to throw back to you for a little bit because, you know, you're kind of at the more extreme end extreme opportunities as a service you run. But to some degree, you know, you're less purely valuation concerned, but you do share some of Matt's approaches around the total addressable market and looking for companies with big, big futures. I think what combines maybe both of your approaches, and frankly, most of us at The Motley Fool, is that sense that people, I think, is it one of our co-founders, David or Tom Gardner, I think, says that people have trouble thinking in kind of exponential ways when you start to compound those numbers, to Matt's point, that at some point it's easy to think about, okay, well, maybe it can grow at 5% this year, maybe next year, maybe the year after, or 10%, but maybe next year's got to be 6%, the one after's got to be 4%, and then 3%. We kind of feel like we're obliged to not extrapolate that growth too much. And frankly, we shouldn't for a lot of companies because they can't do it. But where no one feels comfortable. Most people don't feel comfortable putting a spreadsheet 30% growth for 5 years. It feels like you're being too optimistic somehow, and somehow you should be forced to rein that in somewhat. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of typical of your approach as well?
Yeah. So I think the thing that I would say is that what Matt pointed out, right? Most people, when they do the spreadsheet, they are doing, well, it was 10% last year, so I'm going to put in 10% this year, maybe 8% next year, 6%, 5%, and then I'm going to put a terminal rate of 2%.
Yeah.
But if, you know, the companies that Matt is looking at, a lot of the companies that we look at, extreme opportunities, these are really small companies, and they've just started their, you know, their journey.
Right.
Right. So they're going, you know, I have companies that are growing at 100%.
Right.
Right. There's no reason for me to believe that it's going to now next year grow at 5%. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, if it's growing at 100% and it's, you know, taking market share, it could grow at 200% next year.
Yeah, right.
Makes sense. So if you've got a high growth rate company, I think a lot of the traditional approach, you know, disappears. I think I completely agree with that. We are more growth focused, and we also look at the total addressable market. So if, you know, which is not important when you're looking at something like, you know, Telstra, because you know that, well, it has the market. It's total addressable market. It's got the market.
Right,
and there's only, you know, terminal growth that's going to be to be had, right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna
let Matt jump back in here because I my view, generally speaking, just after you guys have just talked, I think to my mind, the art of valuation becomes more important the smaller the range of a company's possible growth outcomes is. So, you know, if companies are going at somewhere between 20% and 30% for 10 years, you can probably reasonably get, as long as you're not paying, you know, a huge price, you can get a reasonable sense of getting decent value from that. There's very little chance the market's fully valuing a company that's going to grow at 20% for 10 years. Just the market tends not to. On the flip side, to your point, Doc, about Telstra, it's going to grow at something, maybe it's going to decline, quite frankly. And so if you get the valuation wrong, it's almost impossible for the company to have enough opportunity to grow in a way that's going to make that valuation worthwhile. Matt, just from your perspective, is that a reasonable set of assumptions, that the lower the growth rate, the more precise your valuation needs to be right, or to not be wrong, maybe, to the point?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. So I think I shared this last time that we were on, but the kind of metaphor I like to think about with value in a company is kind of like value in a tree. So the traditional value investing view would look at a tree, like, say it's, you know, 2 meters high, it's not too big right now, and they'd say, well, the value of that tree is you could cut it down and it's timber, you know, cut it down, it's dead. it's timber's worth, I don't know what you can make, a couple of baseball bats or something. But but the more growth value investing would look at that tree and say, well, that's actually a redwood tree. That's going to grow to be one of the biggest trees in the forest. We shouldn't be valuing that on what it is today. We should be valuing what it's going to be in the future.
Nice, there you go.
And so I think that kind of, that captures it. If a company is fluctuating between 2% and 3% growth, you've got to be pretty precise to have a meaningful difference to everyone else in the market.
Mm.
And I think all of our advantages come from exploiting inefficiencies in the market and mistakes other people make. And it's just a very common mistake. People can't project forward that much. A lot of the rest of the market are focused on their quarterly bonus. They're not thinking 3-5 years from now.
Right.
I think if you told most analysts what the top company would be over the next 10 years, but it's going to fall 50% in the meantime, they'd be looking to short it. They'd be like, when should I short that stock that's going to fall? Whereas we'd be like, okay, clearly let's just put everything into that.
So, we'll ride the wave.
Yeah, exactly. That would be, I think, the big difference between the two.
Nice.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Doc, you keep a close eye on what's happening in the US. We've also talked a little bit about content and telco so far today.
Mm-hmm.
Wrapping all that together, thinking about streaming content in particular, lots of stuff going on in entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tussle over some of the assets of 21st Century Fox. So we all know the, fair disclosure, I used to work for the company. We all know the trumpets at the beginning of the movie. We know the fanfare and the big logo. Rupert Murdoch's empire is kind of likely to be sold off in bits. And at the moment, there's two people bidding for it, two very, very different bidders. One entertainment company who kind of wants to add Fox's assets to its stable. The other, a different company that's kind of facing its own structural issues and trying to find a way to remain relevant. Tell us what's going on and kind of what you find from this story.
So I can give you a one-word answer. The one-word answer is Netflix.
Actually, a very quick conversation, but give us a couple more. Yeah.
I'll disclose I hold Netflix shares.
All right.
So I think what's happening is with Netflix's over-the-top streaming has basically changed the game in content distribution.
Right.
And that's making the old guard essentially rethink what they can do. One of the things that's happening is these big content companies, they want to all merge, maybe cut costs, and then maybe look at ways to distribute efficiently in the Netflix way.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, Murdoch's company, Disney is interested in most of Fox's movie assets,
mm-hmm.
TV studio assets, and Disney has plans to do its own streaming service like a Netflix, and therefore having this content would help.
Okay, so it builds the library, it gives them some critical mass.
Exactly.
Okay.
And brings, and they can add some things to their Disney, parks and so on and so forth. Right,
and they've done pretty well with it. They bought Pixar, they bought the Star Wars franchises. Yes. They've done a pretty good job of buying and aggregating that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Comcast, on the other hand, is essentially saying, well, I provide broadband.
So just for those who don't know Comcast, how should we think about Comcast? What sort of business is it?
Think of it as Telstra.
Okay.
Is that a pejorative coming
from you? but Telstra without a mobile business, right? Are they more Foxtel than Telstra?
They provide broadband, right? Okay. They provide broadband. So, I mean, they have a broadband business.
Right.
And I think the idea here is that if I can have content added to it, then I can make some of that content free for my broadband users.
Okay.
And therefore, there's an added value, essentially. You have the distribution.
So, they want to differentiate themselves against other broadband providers by having some sort of content that goes along with the parcel.
Yeah. I don't know whether any of this is going to actually work out well for either Disney or Comcast. What I do know is that this might work out very well for Murdoch.
Right.
Right? If there's a bidding war, he makes a lot of money.
Very true.
Which is good for him.
He's done very well in the past.
He's done very well, because the bid started at around $50 billion from Disney for buying these assets.
Right.
That's a lot of money. And this is American $50
billion. Yeah, right.
And then Comcast came in with $65 billion.
Wow, okay.
Right? It's really desperate. Disney is really desperate. And Disney is saying, I'm going to pay you $70
billion. Okay.
Right? Maybe Murdoch is waiting for somebody else to come in.
Now, tell me how Hulu tell me Hulu is and why Hulu is important in this conversation.
So, Hulu is a streaming service.
Okay, so a Netflix-ish kind of
service? It's a Netflix-ish.
Okay.
Which is one-third owned by, Fox's assets, basically. They have shares in it, one-third of the shares.
Mm-hmm.
Disney is another shareholder, I believe, in Hulu. So, I mean,
and if Disney buys Fox, effectively they get majority control of Hulu.
They got majority control of Hulu, and they maybe look to merge Hulu and their own streaming service. So, there's some maybe game plan there.
Right.
I think all of this, if I have to say something, is they are too late to the game, in the sense that Netflix has got, what, 125 million people worldwide. Netflix is no longer just a distributor of content. It is the largest producer of content today.
Right.
It's spending $8 billion on content. So I think, you know, and in the content production, if you think about people who produce content, they look at Netflix and say, oh, they have a new way of doing things. We get all this, you know, 125 million people worldwide that we can simultaneously distribute our content to. They don't do pilots like the other studios do. It's very liberating for the artists, and therefore the artists, you know, are migrating towards the likes of Netflix.
So it's
Netflix and the tech eating the dinosaur's lunch.
So does either party win or do better by buying Fox, or do you think they're both wasting their money because they can't compete with the likes of Netflix?
So I don't have a firm view on it. I mean, big mergers are hard. Right. So you pay $70 billion and you try to get some cost synergies. Some people are going to be really annoyed. They're going to lose their job. You're going to try to, you know, streamline things. I really don't know. I mean, but what can Disney really do? I mean, Disney is caught in the middle and has to do something. So,
And I have to reference at least one of the big failed takeovers of, I want to say the late 90s, I'm pretty sure it was, AOL, the internet provider, and Time Warner, the movie studio, among other things, kind of merged and created AOL, Time Warner. It was a horrible, horrible deal. It got broken up subsequently. Comcast and Fox feels a little bit to me, a little bit like the same, this kind of unholy marriage. It feels, at least you know, price aside, the assets feel like a better fit inside Disney simply because Disney has the background. It's already in the content business. Disney feels like the more natural home for the Fox assets and probably a lower risk acquisition. Is that fair to say?
Well, I actually disagree with that. The reason I disagree with that is, I mean, Disney knows everything about making movies.
Right.
It knows about making shows. Why does it really need Fox's assets? Actually, it could continue creating good movies. It's got Pixar. It's got the Star Wars franchise, right?
Okay, it's bought Pixar and Marvel and Star Wars before and done very, very well. Why would Fox be any different, do you think?
I think that was a different time, right? You know, the distribution was essentially entirely theater-based, and then you did distributions of DVDs, and then you put these things on iTunes and
sounds
so on and so forth,
yep.
Right? But it's a different world today.
Right.
And I think in that, you know, they don't need new content. I think they've got enough content of their own. They can produce new content on their own. So I'm not really sure what actually this gives them.
Or as a Netflix shareholder, maybe you're hoping it doesn't become a viable competitor to Netflix.
None of these guys are anywhere near beating Netflix, you know. Netflix has beaten them to the punch. I mean, it's a bigger company today in terms of market capitalization than Disney.
That's
so
amazing, hey?
Yeah.
Absolutely astonishing.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, now we couldn't let you go, Matt, without an opportunity to saddle up on the Motley Fool Money high horse and take us for a lap around the track.
Mm-hmm.
What has got your blood boiling this week, mate?
I think I'm generally a pretty happy guy, Scott. Somebody asked me this morning. I was trying to struggle, but
to talk about housing, man. Housing is beautiful.
Scott insisted I take a break from the housing high horse.
That poor horse has been flogged with an inch of his life. Let's give that one a rest and jump
over. I wouldn't insist.
Yeah, so something that has been on my mind recently is fake AI companies. So
Fake AI.
So I love AI companies, and Nirbhana knows a big fan. He has a PhD in computer science. We talk about this stuff a lot.
We do.
We love real companies that are really pushing the envelope here. But it just seems to be the flavor of the month now is for any tiny little small cap with zero revenue to say that it's an AI company just because it plugs in. Maybe it uses some data or, you know, it runs, I don't know, probably an Excel spreadsheet on it. And so it's just quite frustrating for someone who really appreciates good businesses that are pushing technology on the cutting edge to have to deal with that.
So okay, are you saying these companies are frauds or that maybe they're being a little bit too liberal with the truth, calling themselves AI, or is AI just become such a nonsense term that it's almost irrelevant now?
I think that they are just pushing the envelope. I think this happens every time with every wave. So every company was an Internet of Things company a couple of years ago. And then they were all some, like all the miners were doing something for electric cars, lithium.
Yes, and graphene
Graphene and rare earth materials and all this stuff. It's just rubbish. And it kind of distorts the picture for anyone who's really legitimate, which is what I like to look at. So yeah, those guys get my blood boiling.
All right. And how do you define the difference between real and fake AI? Just if for our listeners who are thinking, okay, well, I kind of like the idea of AI. You like the idea of AI from what you're telling us.
Yeah.
What give us a couple of pointers as to what our listeners should be looking for if they're trying to think about, yes, they've all got exciting stories. And so, you know, we all open an email or open a newspaper, or maybe you're on a chat forum and you see this great story about this new AI company.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, some of them probably sound like you think they're going to win, but then a lot are probably not going to win.
Mm.
Without giving away all the secret sauce, how do you go about differentiating what you think is real, valuable business kind of value creating AI, and mm-hmm. what is just smoke and mirrors?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of smoke and mirrors on the ASX, unfortunately, at the small cap, the very small end of the spectrum. Amen. So I think a big thing for me is just are they able to generate revenue from this opportunity that they're presenting? So a company, there's often you'll get these companies that are talking a very big game, and there's no customers that are willing to pay them for that. So it's, I mean, sure, maybe they're going to become great, but I like to see, is there people who are actually willing to pay for what you're offering?
Okay.
And particularly around the AI, is this something that is really making a meaningful difference to the product? Like, to customers, does that, yeah, that's kind of the big factor. And then, I guess, do they control it, or are they really just packaging up someone else's product?
Like, right, okay.
If McDonald's opens McDonald's.com, it doesn't make it a tech company, you know what I mean?
I don't know about that. BigMac.com might be fine. So is evidence the difference in it? Looking through what you're saying, I think what you're saying is the hype is fine. And yes, if you were to buy, you know, the eventual winner, if you bought Amazon at 5 cents, you're going to make a fortune.
Yeah.
But it took a while between that price and some other price before you knew it was actually a viable business with a decent future.
Yeah.
Are you looking for kind of a point at which you feel like the AI is demonstrating value in and of itself to kind of jump on that bandwagon?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible to go earlier, and there's be some that you could identify potentially, but a very easy test is just traction. Are there people that are willing to pay you real money from their wallet for the AI that you're selling?
Not Bitcoin?
It's a whole nother wave. Don't get me, my blood's boiling more than I thought. I'm not as happy as when I started this conversation. So I think there's a real traction. And do you really own the product, I guess, is the other big one. If you're just plugging in someone else's thing, they're the ones that really own it. They're the AI company.
Very, very good. Gents, we have gone well over time, but thank you both for your contributions. That does wrap us up. But before we go, don't forget, you listener can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast, and we think you should, through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. Close your ears, Doc. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big 5-star rating, because it does help us. It helps other people find the podcast, and we do really appreciate your feedback. If you do want to get in touch with us, info@fool.com.au, or you can follow us on Twitter @TheMotleyFoolAU. Very surprising, I know. Send us a question, send us a comment. Let us know what you're thinking and what you'd like us to talk about. Well, that's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.